This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Ken, welcome to this Friday the 13th in October edition of The Politics Guys.
Yeah. And for Friday the 13th, I went ahead and because I was cursed, I got COVID.
The cursed Ken. I mean, there's kind of a ring to that. I hadn't thought about that.
So I am doing this show from home. I'm not out. I'm quarantining, but I'm under the I am a little bit under the gun with the COVID.
You know, and I'll say before we get started, you sound really chipper for a guy with COVID. I'm not going to lie. I mean, could this just be, and this is just me spitballing here, Ken, but given that I think we've all recognized now that the COVID vaccine is, in fact, just nanobots, do you think that your left-wing positions is the reason that you continue to get COVID?
I wonder. I mean, you know, I was telling you, Trey, and I don't mind telling the listeners, I've had all six vaccines. I've been vaccinated six times, including the recent new vaccine. And yet this is the fourth time I've got COVID. So I definitely have been like probably the most frequently infected person who's taken all six vaccines, but at least they've all been mild cases.
No, I hear you. I hear you. We were talking about the show. I've been on a similar kind of schedule, but I have to do other kinds of things. I'm weird. I'm an immunocompromised man. So, you know, there it is. Well, this is going to be a different kind of show in the sense that we're going to take on fewer stories, Ken. And, you know, we had talked about that this week. And that's because, you know, we've just got two, I think, really emblematic cases of why what we do on The Politics Guys is so different from what you're going to get. You know, one, we want to obviously talk about what's happening in the Gaza Strip with Israel, with Hamas. And I just couldn't help, as I continued to watch that unfold starting last weekend, one of the things, the media professor in me just couldn't get over the fact that you're having these stories with absolutely really no context to them. And so we're really going to try to delve into some context a lot more deeply on both of these. And then if we have some time, we have some time. But that, you know, we're really going to kind of take it that way. So, you know, if you were hoping for a deep dive into things, listeners, today is the day that Ken and I are going to do that. And I spent a lot of time trying to prep on that front. And so what we're going to start with, our first story, is going to be the violence in and around the Gaza Strip between Israel and Hamas. You know, we often do the international stories. And so I think it's apropos that the two of us are the ones tackling this. So let me just start off by giving us some background, right? So for listeners, I'm hoping this kind of helps us really have a better conversation about this and that you might have a better context for what's going on. So if you're confused, the Gaza Strip is located in the southwest portion of what we consider to be Israel. And that means that its western border is the Mediterranean Sea, and its southwestern border is with Egypt. It's a tiny strip of land in some ways. And it connects specifically there to Egypt at the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the rest of this kind of unaffiliated territory, and what I mean by that, this is a territory that is not a state, is surrounded and has been controlled at different junctures by different states, but is surrounded on the other sides by Israel. Now, in terms of size, like I said, it's small. It's about 140 square miles, but it's got a population, and this sometimes shocks people, of 1.5 million, with approximately half of those individuals living in refugee camps. Now, how and why does this all start? Well, Contemporary Gaza begins in 1947 when the United Nations approved a plan. Now, really, at that juncture, it's not the United Nations, but the League of Nations, to partition the Britain under having two different states. There was going to be a Jewish and an Arab state after World War II. Palestinian Arabs were allotted the town of Gaza and the larger non-contiguous territory that we now call the West Bank. Now, when Britain a year later ends up ceding control of that area to Israel, Israel accepted the boundaries, but the Arab Palestinians did not. And so this ends up leading to a war on May 15, 1948, right after the British exit. So that conflict is actually between Israel and all of the surrounding Arab countries. So that's Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt. Gaza is a really important part of that campaign specifically for Egypt because Egypt was attempting to capture the coastline. Now, this fails, and Egypt's ability to move forward specifically fails, and that leaves Egypt controlling that strip of land about 40 kilometers long, about 6 to 8 wide, on that in the wake of that war. Now, the war ends in February of 1949, and those territorial boundaries are formally drawn up into the region that we now call the Gaza Strip, with the city of Gaza near the northern edge of its border. And that's important for what's been happening recently and the threats that have been made today. That is, it is, and now it is closer to Israel, the city, than it is to Egypt. Now, as scholars note, in the wake of the Arab-Israeli War, or as Israelis think of it as their independence war, you get about 700 to 800,000 Palestinians becoming refugees living inside the Gaza Strip. Now, history's not done, right? There's more to this. So Gaza then, at that point, remains under Egyptian rule until the Suez Canal crisis in 1956. Now, for those of you who don't know, just briefly, that's when Egypt tries to nationalize the Suez Canal Company, and France, Britain, and Israel attempt to control the canal and seize it away from Egypt. And as part of that, the Gaza Strip becomes central to the plan. Israel actually takes it over, but then it will eventually relinquish it back to Egypt in the afterwards. In 1967, Israel launches a strike against Arab states that appeared to be mobilizing for war. It's kind of a preemptive strike. And so over a 5-day period, the 6-day war occurs. And Israel ends up controlling militarily the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights up in Syria, and most importantly, in some ways, for most of you, the West Bank, right there along with East Jerusalem. Now, that's the 6 Days War, as it's known in Israel. It leaves about 1 million Arabs under Israeli rule, and it's clear to Palestinians that Arabs are not going to be able to fix their situation, and kind of the current instability and the back and forth begin. Now, in the 1990s, there seemed to be some work to finding a solution to exist. And during the Clinton administration on September 13th, 1993, Israeli Prime Minister Rabin and Palestinian Liberation Organization, or the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas, signed the Declaration of Principles of Inner Self-Government Arrangements, or as we commonly refer to that, the Oslo Accords. Both sides agreed that there's going to be a Palestinian authority, in other words, kind of a governmental structure, although there is no state. And importantly for Israel, the PLO ends up renouncing terrorism and recognizes Israel's right to exist. As a result of this agreement, Israel would pull out from most of Gaza during this period. Unfortunately, though, the prime minister ends up being assassinated by an Israeli who opposes the Oslo Accords on religious ground. That murder is then followed by a series of terrorist attacks by this organization called Hamas. This leads us to another thing I have a lot of students and listeners ask me about, and that's what's Hamas and where does it come from? Well, Hamas is actually formalized a decade earlier in 1987, and a lot of what we think about of this comes from the United States Director of National Intelligence. The Hamas has its roots in the Muslim Brotherhood, and for those of you who don't speak Arabic, the word itself actually means zeal, but it's also an acronym, and when translated into English, stands for the Islamic Resistance Movement, or you might think of this as the zeal for the Islamic Resistance Movement. The group's charter calls for establishing an Islamic Palestinian state in place of Israel and has rejected and continues to reject all agreements the PLO made with Israel, which includes, importantly, the Oslo Accords. Hamas argues that liberating Palestine from Israel is a religious duty not just for them, but for all Muslims. Hamas exists in both the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Now, politically and importantly, not that long ago, I guess from our point of, my point of view, your point of view, Ken, in 2006, Hamas is able to win control of the Palestinian Authority in elections. And they don't have a complete majority, but after some additional internal fighting with some more secular elements, it ends up getting complete control over that politically. And it has, since that time, continued to use suicide bombings, such as in 2008, and a continual bombardment of rocket and mortar attacks on Israel. So how do we bring all of this to this week? So there has been numerous attempts to either try and settle and control or to leave alone those regions, but neither Egypt nor Israel have what you would think of as a soft border with the Gaza Strip. So as a result, in addition to the poverty, according to the United Nations, there are 8 official refugee camps within Gaza, which even today, as of right now, are accommodating 600,000 people. Now, many of those camps were actually created in the wake of that Arab-Israeli war. Others have emerged more recently. But the Gaza Strip, 81% of the population lives in poverty, and around 1 million of its residents rely daily on food aid. Now, understanding these conditions might help us understand the popularity of Hamas. Hamas has argued that the only possible move forward is militarily, and they have used their power to have a complete takeover of the Gaza Strip. Hamas, along with others, have used rockets over the last number of years to try to give it a better positioning with Israel. And Israel, in response, beginning in 2007, has considered Hamas a terrorist organization, along with a number of other countries, including the United States. And as a result of a terrorist organization being in control, has cut power, water, and other inputs the Gaza Strip. And this has led to, again, additional difficulties between the regions. Now, this also has to think a little bit about terrorism, right? That's kind of here. You know, we've heard, and you've probably heard about Saudi Arabia and other countries not recognizing Hamas as a terrorist organization. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about terrorism. I busted out a bunch of my terrorism books in preparation for this show. But just as a reminder, I get this from Bruce Hoffman, who's kind of a famous terrorism scholar. He gives a really good definition of it. He says at base, terrorism is the pursuit of political power through both actual violence, but then the threat of the continued use of that violence to a large, sustained civilian population. Now, Hamas's popularity and the sympathy that it evokes from the Arab world, despite being potentially a terrorist organization, is it's pretty easily understood as an empirical phenomenon. So you have people who are out of power, who feel they've been ghettoed, aren't willing to have their political preferences in the open for a host of reasons. And as a result, as the work of Martha Crenshaw shows us, that is a breeding ground for the logic of terrorism. And so this is what we have to leading up until this week. Now, you might say, well, why not Egypt? Why don't people come across Egypt? But keep in mind, even starting in 2011, Egypt has only allowed very few people to pass. And by 2013, has a complete closed border with the Gaza Strip. So this leads us to this past week and the atrocities that occurred. So on Saturday morning of this last week, at the end of the Jewish festival of Sukkot, Hamas attacked from the Gaza Strip from air, sea, and ground. What we now know is that thousands of missiles were fired from Gaza indiscriminately into Israel, in part to allow for paragliders to follow in the wake of those rockets. At the same time, armed fighters, many motorized, followed in bulldozers that breached those blockades of the fences and the borders that separate Israel from the Gaza Strip. It also included motorboats storming the beaches of the north to the north of the Gaza Strip, along with a number of individuals on motorcycles and other motor vehicles, then coming behind those openings. And the individuals that Hamas has killed and attacked at this point seem to be relatively random, women, children, babies, the elderly, And some, and this is what brings us to some of the things we're going to have to talk about today, we have actually hostages taken and brought back into the Gaza Strip. As a matter of fact, a musical festival was is one source of information where Hamas militants killed down 260 partygoers. The individuals who are being held captive are being used in this kind of a ransom. And numbers are going to continue to change. Ken and I are recording this on, again, Friday, October 13th. But as I've seen right now, most news outlets have somewhere in the vicinity of 1,600 Israelis dead, about 1,500 Hamas soldiers dead, and about 2,900 in additional people injured. 14 among the dead are American citizens. And of today, it looked like we're starting to get a number, but the last time I looked, we did not have a firm number on how many American citizens were being held hostage, according to President Biden, but there is a number of them as well. Now, Israel has since launched a response, and that response has killed approximately 1,000 people, again, as of the most recent data that I have, inside of Gaza, and injured approximately 5,000 others. Many of the dead and injured also include women and children. Additionally, Israel is issuing weapons, including ARs, to civilians in the communities surrounding Gaza, because this was a surprise attack, and that's something I know we're also going to be talking about, Ken. Some in Israel's parliament are already arguing that it's time for Israel to simply level the Gaza Strip. As a matter of fact, today, this morning, there were evacuation orders set off. They have been coming in a variety of ways, but they have come most recently by warplane, telling individuals who are civilians that they can't shield Hamas anymore and they have to evacuate to the south. But of course, there's not a lot of space, as we've already just talked about, but they're asking them to evacuate Gaza City, not Gaza Strip. Internationally, the debate, of course, is whether Hamas is a terrorist organization or not, and what level of response from Israel should and can be. And we have to look no further than some pieces here in the United States. That has been taking up, I think, most of the oxygen. So, Ken, that's a lot going on right there. And I think I'll pause right there to get some of your thoughts on what's happening.
First, two very minor corrections to what was otherwise a really excellent overview. The United Nations did exist in 1947, and it was the United Nations that mandated the state creation of the State of Israel. That was the UN started in 46, so it wasn't the League of Nations. And the other one was the Oslo Accords were actually signed by Yasser Arafat on behalf of the Palestinians, not by the current president, Mahmoud Abbas, but by his predecessor. But other than that, yeah, that was a good summary. I guess a couple other aspects of this that I think I might highlight in terms of your history that I think help explain the current conflict is that after the Oslo Accords were signed in during the Clinton administration, as you mentioned, really Israel did not live up to some of its obligations. And I think that caused and you mentioned part of that was because of the Rabin assassination and then the sort of swing to the right that happened in Israel after that. But Israel was supposed to be actually starting a process towards a two-state solution with an independent Palestine, but on the ground, the Netanyahu government and his predecessor Likud governments, which is the Likud is like the conservative party in Israel, they really did launch on a pretty full-scale project of building as many new Israeli settlements as possible in the West Bank, in the area that was supposed to actually become the new Palestinian state, and the more Israeli settlements that were on the ground in that area, the more impossible it was becoming to actually make progress towards creating an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank. And meanwhile, Gaza, Israel took the opposite approach. Gaza is much smaller than the West Bank and much more densely populated. And the Israelis did not build settlements there. In fact, they more or less completely withdrew from there. But the first time there was an election in Gaza after the Israeli withdrawal in 2006, that's the first time they were allowed to have, first and only time they were allowed to have an election in Gaza. Hamas won, and that was a great disappointment, I think, to everybody who was hoping that there could be a two-state solution, because the other Palestinian party, the party of Mahmoud Abbas, which is in power in the West Bank, the Fatah party, is trying to work towards a two-state solution. But Hamas has always had as its platform that it won't accept any state of Israel under any circumstances, and that it will use violence and terrorism to try to end the state of Israel. And so that, and once they came in the election in 2006, they never held another election. So so you've had this kind of divergence within the Palestinian occupied territories, where I think in the West Bank, the Palestinians primarily have tried to use political means to advance their aspirations to an independent Palestinian state. And I think really the Israelis have really tried to undermine that with the settlement building. Whereas in Gaza, in contrast, you have this Hamas rather than Fatah. You have a Palestinian party there that's committed only to violence, terrorism, and the ending of the state of Israel entirely. And sometimes that plays out in more or less horrific ways. But I think the most horrific attacks were the ones that we saw this week.
And that leads us to something where you kind of had a unique point of view on this, Ken. And that is, I think internationally, a lot of people were surprised by the level of surprise that Israel had, right? There are reports that Egypt had submitted information to Israel that an attack was coming, that there had been some suggestions by lower levels in the Israeli military that an attack was coming. But it still ends up being this surprise attack. And you had, I thought, a kind of insightful take on that. So I want to probe you to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I've kind of thought about it even more since I wrote to you. So my views have evolved a little bit. But so on the question of, you know, how is it possible that Israel was so surprised by this surprise attack from Hamas? There have been many attacks from Hamas before, but they, because Israeli surveillance is fairly sophisticated, and Israel does have human intelligence as well from inside of Gaza, all prior attacks, of which there have been many, have been reasonably contained by Israel. But this one was maybe the most massive attack ever. The mobilization for it certainly involved quite a lot of people and must have involved quite a lot of communications that could have been surveilled. And yet, you know, it seems to have been, you know, that Israel was caught completely by surprise, which is what made the terrorist attack so effective. And I've been trying to think about how that could happen. And I think, you know, certainly some of it, the reporting is indicating, was because the Hamas figured out a way to technologically to defeat some of the surveillance technology. And I hadn't realized that when I first wrote to you. But I think the issue was that the Israeli military maintains both a lot of surveillance cameras and a lot of surveillance drones and a lot of surveillance eavesdropping within the communication systems. So they generally do get quite a lot of information out of Gaza, which they then have to analyze. But I think one technological thing that I learned about in the past couple of days is that you know, most of the way that information travels from the surveillance cameras and the surveillance microphones and the wiretaps back to the Israeli military is primarily through wireless communications links that make use of cell tower networks. And so I think the Hamas was able to figure out that if they could sabotage some of the cell towers, they could actually interfere with the, you know, the process of collecting intelligence. And it appears that did happen. So that's one thing I wanted to acknowledge. But what I also had told you about, and this is, I think, what you're asking me about, is that separate and apart from that, I think one of the issues that always bedevils all counterintelligence work is that intelligence agencies always have to try to figure out, when they're collecting information, whether the information is somehow disinformation that the enemy intended for them to collect in order to deceive them. And I think the Israeli Mossad, more than most intelligence services, maybe similarly to the KGB, but that they are extremely skeptical that information that they're receiving could be disinformation. And a lot of that comes from the legacy of the Mossad was, you know, in its early days when it was set up, it worked extremely closely with American CIA counterintelligence chief James Jesus Angleton. And James Jesus Angleton was, you know, really a fanatic who did a tremendous amount of harm to our CIA because he took his ideas about needing to route out enemy disinformation to such an extreme that he really never credited any intelligence information that he received. All intelligence information that he received, he always viewed it as though, well, if we have this information, it's got to be because the enemy wants us to have this information, and that's got to mean that the enemy is got a sophisticated disinformation operation. And in fact, another part of Angleton's thinking was that if there were other CIA officers within the CIA who were giving more credence to espionage product than he was, he would assume that that means that part of the Soviet disinformation operation is that they've planted these moles inside the CIA. And yep. So you have CIA officials saying, you know, this is legitimate information we're getting from these legitimate KGB defectors. And Angleton would say, well, no, these are fake KGB defectors, and you're a Soviet mole inside the CIA. And that's why you are telling us you believe this information. And he was so, lost in what people sometimes call the wilderness of mirrors, or sometimes called sick think, that we really made no use of any perfectly good information we got from Soviet defectors through most of the 60s. Anyhow, Angleton eventually got fired in the early 70s. But I do think, you know, he worked very closely with people like Teddy Kollek, who was the first mayor of Jerusalem after the State of Israel was formed, and who then went on to form the Mossad. And I do think a lot of Mossad culture may be a little bit infected by that, so that kind of hyper suspicion could have tainted, you know, I think Israel's thinking on this would be, well, you know, the Hamas is always launching minor terrorist attacks, but we are so much stronger than them that, you know, it's impossible for them to actually harm us militarily. And so they're only able to try to harm us with psychological disinformation operations. And so if we're hearing about some large scale military operation, some large scale terrorist operation that's going to achieve more cause more damage to Israel than any Hamas operation into Israel has ever caused before, then what we're probably hearing is a disinformation operation designed maybe to psych us out, or maybe to draw the Israeli military down to the Gaza border to draw it away from the Lebanon border, so that actually Hamas's partners Hezbollah could attack up there. You know, that a lot of that kind of thinking about, you know, why do they want, instead of thinking this information is true, thinking, you know, why does Hamas want us to think that this is what's going to happen, and kind of dismissing it that way. So I think that could have played a role. There's one other theory that I just read in the Jerusalem Times the other day as well. And the Jerusalem Times was blaming a lot of this on Netanyahu personally, and saying that Netanyahu actually had pursued a strategy because of his strong desire never to live up to the Oslo Accords and never to allow there to be any independent Palestinian state, that he actually basically was happy with the idea that Hamas was governing in Gaza and Fatah was governing in the West Bank, and that Netanyahu liked that better than having Fatah in both, because if Fatah was in both, then you'd have a reasonable negotiating partner and they would have the sympathy of the world. But as long as you have Hamas in one, then you've got the Palestinians divided against each other, and you've got Hamas being an entity that the whole world has no sympathy for, because they're basically fanatical terrorists. And so that another theory I read was that Netanyahu actually, you know, didn't understand how serious of an attack that this was going to be, but he thought that there was going to be a fairly significant attack out of Gaza along the lines of what's happened in the past, and that he actually did want to allow that to happen rather than stop it, you know, not expecting the scale that it was going to be on, but just wanting to keep kind of the world focused on you know, the fact that Hamas is terrorists who can never possibly be allowed to have a state, rather than keeping the world focused on the idea that the Oslo Accords provide a path towards a Palestinian state, and that the Palestinians in Gaza in particular have really been living in what amounts to the world's largest open air outdoor prison, you know, for a generation now. And it's a very unsustainable situation that, you know, I think otherwise would really draw a lot of the world's sympathy. But when they do things like this, that sort of solves that problem for Netanyahu.
Well, you know, that brings us, I think, to the big, and I thought we'd start on the international side of things. And that is, you know, what are the international players? What's the international solution? I mean, not to bring up a small point, you know, part of that is to say that there are the worries of the connections between Hamas and Iran. There seems to be some connections between Saudi Arabia and Iran on this particular issue, you know, to bring it to the United States. This is brought into question our releasing of held funds for Iran, saying, you know, this kinds of backing is what allows Hamas and other terrorist organizations to exist. But yet at the same time, and I think you say it quite rightly, you know, the Gaza Strip is a ghetto in that sense. It's also a prison in that sense, but it's one in which there is no even potential exit. And it's particularly hard, I think, a lot of times when I look at least at kind of knee-jerk responses, it's not even as if Egypt has been willing to be a partner in that play. It doesn't ever feel like there is an obvious exit solution, just a lot of position taking. And what do you think about that, Ken?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the window where there's going to be any kind of win-win solution, you know, has probably closed by now. And in fact, I take it that one of the military goals that Israel put into effect yesterday and today, when they warned the people in Gaza, you know, we're going to be really just bombing Gaza City back into the Stone Age.
Well,
now,
and they're going to go in military. Yeah. So there's going to be a ground, just to be clear, and this was new as of today, Ken, they're going to move in forces as well into the Gaza Strip in an attempt to find some of these individuals. So this is more than bombing at this juncture even, too.
Yeah, but I was saying they're actually warning the majority of people in the whole Gaza Strip that they have to leave their homes, which are in the Gaza City area, right?
So
there's something like 1.7 million people in the Gaza Strip, and 1.1 million of them are in metropolitan Gaza City. And they said to those 1.1 million people, you need to move south and get out of the way, because we're going to bomb your city back to the Stone Age, and you don't want to be hit by our bombs. Now, if you take the majority of the population in the whole Gaza Strip and tell it to move down to the southern half of the Gaza Strip, where there's no place to house them, this was the less urban, less developed part of the Gaza Strip that they're all being moved to. It does seem to me one of the purposes of doing that is to create an international humanitarian refugee crisis, so that they will have to leave. Some of them will have to leave, and some other countries will have to take them, right? And so you know, because no other countries are stepping up to take them. But I think the more intolerable the situation becomes, the more untenable the situation becomes. You know, squeezing 1.7 million people into a part of the desert where there's no housing for most of them, while the city is bombed back to the Stone Age. I think that is going to kind of force certainly the international refugee agencies and organizations, the UN, you know, to kind of come in there and get a corridor to get them out of there, and then put pressure, you know, on other Arab countries, maybe European countries, maybe the US, you know, to take some of them. And I think that that's extremely intentional on Israel's part. I think they want that population reduced. I don't think they really want to just, you know, start killing people in very large numbers, but I think they want to make it so they really, you know, that the international community starts seeing that they're going to have to step up and take some of them. So that would be kind of my take on that. I think Egypt, you know, does not want Gaza back at all. And in fact, that's been a long story. One part of the story,
and they don't want Palestinians to come over.
Right. I mean, one part of the story that you told in the 50s, but I want to give a little more detail on it because I think it's instructive here, is that in the original UN mandate in 47, The UN did not, very consciously, did not define what the exact borders of Israel would be, but it said more generically that it would recognize the state of Israel, and that the state of Israel would be created primarily out of British Palestine, the former British Palestine. Now, the British Palestine map included the Gaza Strip. So the Gaza Strip had been in British Palestine and, you know, presumptively could have been in the state of Israel, although it was a densely populated Arab area that bordered Egypt, and very few Jews lived there. And so, you know, when the 1948 war happened, just as soon as Israel was recognized and Egypt took that strip, which you talked about, Egypt didn't keep it very long.
No.
So Egypt had the Gaza Strip, and long before the other wars that you talked about, you know, because the next significant war was in 67, but long before that, Egypt got sick of having the Gaza Strip, and it set up kind of a puppet republic that it administered in partnership with Syria and Lebanon. And so there was a little independent country in Gaza, but that actually happened because Egypt didn't want to keep it after they got it. And then when Israel took it back in the 67 war and military occupied it for a decade, the Gaza Strip was the smaller piece of Egyptian territory that Israel took. And Israel also took the whole rest of the Sinai Peninsula, which was much larger. And then when they had the Camp David Accords in the 70s, and Israel and Egypt negotiated a peace treaty and with mutually recognized borders, Israel basically wanted to give back all the Egyptian territory. And Egypt didn't want Gaza back. They wanted the rest of the Sinai back. And so I think their experience with it did not make them think that it was an asset that they really wanted. And they do have a border with Gaza now. So there's Gaza is basically fenced in. It really is a prison. But there's two ways in from Israel, and there's one way in from Egypt. And Egypt seals that border more than Israel does
since 2013. Yeah,
and they've all had them seized. They've all had it sealed now, and so, you know, Egypt could be letting people out right now, but
they aren't.
Not. And yeah, they aren't, right. So it's I do think that any kind of humanitarian solution that could actually work, I think, is going to have to involve people leaving Gaza. But you know, what it's going to take to get the world to accept them, you know, I we'll have to see what unfolds this week.
And I think this is one that can be a little bit difficult. I mean, there's undoubtedly individuals who don't want to leave the Gaza Strip. But putting that aside, there are also clearly, I mean, as I was talking about earlier, we already have a huge number of individuals who have lived in effectively refugee status, you know, for decades. Who would, it seems likely, when you take a look at the data, you take a look at even like qualitative studies, people talking with them, that they would want to exit. But there, you know, there has only been teeny tiny, you know, a few thousand people kind of exit options. Why do you think it is the case that other Arab countries don't want to take in the Palestinians who want to exit?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a tricky issue. I think there's different levels of different kinds of reasons. One, I think a lot of it was originally rooted in hostility towards Israel, because the Palestinian situation it's a provocation in the whole Arab world that keeps people people in that part of the world anti-Zionist, anti-Israel. Right. And so if there was a kind of satisfactory resolution of the Palestinian problem where, you know, Palestinians found someplace else and moved there and were happy to have moved there, you know, then, you know, the pressure against Israel might dissipate. And so I think some of it came from that certain Arab governments you know, their primary objective was to maintain an anti-Israel stance. And so they saw the plight of the Palestinians as something they wanted to perpetuate rather than resolve, because resolving it would diminish that sentiment. And then I think the other kind of problem is that in different Arab countries, you know, they all to varying extents are trying to not have they all have problems with terrorism and with domestic strife, right? So they all don't want to have terrorist organizations using their country as a base to the extent that they can stop that, unless it's government sponsored terrorism, and then some of them do like that. But
of course, that's a whole different category, right?
But I think generally, unless it's government sponsored terrorism, they don't want freelance terrorists operating out of their countries. And I think like the more things evolved, you know, Egypt had its own problems with organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think they just didn't want Hamas. You know, so that as Hamas became kind of the face of the people of Gaza. And I think, you know, although, you know, Hamas doesn't allow elections, and I'm sure there's many people in Gaza who don't support these terrorist acts. You know, on the other hand, you know, a whole lot of people in Gaza were involved in all these terrorist acts, and a whole lot of people in Gaza do support Hamas. And if a government is going to kind of take these Palestinians in, I think they're going to have to expect that some of those people are going to be in the mix.
Yeah, and I think it's hard for individuals sometimes. Again, this is not, I want to be clear, this is not in any way a moral justification for what was happening with Hamas. But empirically speaking, it's not probably shock. It's not probably at all. As I brought up, terrorism and counterterrorism scholars earlier, it's not a shock that we see non-state terrorist organizations in a place like the Gaza Strip, because it meets all of what we would think of as being the check boxes for making that more likely. And as we talk about that and that poverty, and I think that can be sometimes hard to separate out. But here's the other piece of this, Ken, and I wanted to kind of bring us around, because obviously we're also focused, we're Americans, you know, we're asking what ought to be the policy positions of the United States on things like this. I'll be honest, I have had long issues with some of fellow scholars, especially in the decolonizing literature and world. I was really shocked. I kind of at first thought, oh, you know what, this is the right-wing guys talking about it. But there has been a large response in the United States, you know, kind of, I don't want to exaggerate, but pro-ish Hamas, and saying, you know, the only way that you're going to have real peace is you're going to have to have Hamas, you know, fight with weapons and come up and attack and do things. And this includes, I was looking at it carefully because I kept thinking this can't be as big as it is, but it is. You know, we're talking about the director of Global Middle East Studies at UC Irvine. We're talking about Yale's director of religious studies. We're talking about a number of professors of sociology in Canada at large institutions. I mean, just to name a few. And again, as I laid that out, it should be apparent that I'm familiar with that history and that era. But to me, it seems a little weird. It seems like the left in the United States is having a little bit of a crisis on this front. And it's a little shocking to me. And, you know, sometimes you ask me, like, what do you think the right's thinking on this? I'm going to ask you on that front. It was hard. There were some things I was reading from people on the left, and I just thought, guys, what are you talking about? Like, I can't get on board with you at all. Like, this is evil.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know exactly what you were reading. I mean, I would think of President Biden as kind of a standard bearer for the mainstream left in America. And
well,
I think I was specifically saying
a little bit about kind of our I would call it the more academic left and the decolonized left, right? So let me make that a distinction. I was not directed at, say, your like the Democratic Party.
Right. Yeah, because I think there's a pretty great deal of unity in the U.S. Congress right now on these issues, and the Biden administration that everybody is supporting. I mean, really, I would say the American government is supporting the Israeli response that we're seeing, even though I think aspects of the Israeli response are
potentially
in violation of international humanitarian law, and you might expect the U.S. to possibly say something about that, but they seem to think that the provocations from Hamas that happened last week were so severe that they seem to justify such a forceful response, even in cases where it may seem that civilian populations are being targeted, or that certain kinds of practices like not allowing water in, which so far they're not allowing. And I don't know what will happen with
water or power.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any humanitarian law that says you have to let them have power, but I think there is humanitarian law that says you have to let them have water. And they haven't run out of water yet, but it'll happen in a few days. And So we'll see what happens then. But some aspects of that, I think it is interesting to me, more on in the other direction from what you said, that I think the world at so far, and certainly the United States more than most countries, has just been squaring up 100% in support of Israel's response and not really asking them to moderate it very much, which, you know, in many past situations, the U.S. has asked Israel to moderate some of its responses so as not to antagonize the rest of the Middle Eastern countries. But most of the other Middle Eastern countries seem to be staying relatively quiet about this now, too, because I think they see this as an attempt by Iran to interfere with peace processes that were proceeding between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and that had already proceeded between the United Arab Emirates and other Gulf states and Israel, and previously, you know, Egypt and Lebanon. So I'm not Lebanon. I'm sorry, Egypt and Jordan.
Okay, I was about to say that. I was like,
Lebanon. No, Egypt and Jordan. So I mean, slowly but surely, more Middle Eastern Arab countries were normalizing relations with Israel. And the countries that have done so have not criticized Israel very much right now. And Egypt apparently was even still involved in intelligence sharing with Israel about Hamas. And so I think Israel's getting a pretty free hand. But I guess in terms of, you know, and again, without knowing exactly what you read, you know, I think if I was going to try to, channel some of my own, inner leftist thought here, I think that it is important to realize that the people in Gaza really have no hope, right? They really have no hope. You're talking about a country, by the way, not that it's a country, but a territory where the median age is 17, right? So half the people in Gaza, you know, were literally born in a prison and have lived their whole lives in a prison and haven't done anything wrong and can't leave that prison. And I think that kind of desperation is not sustainable. And so I think it is understandable that you know, at a certain point, people feel that anything is better than the status quo. I mean, I think you could make some small comparisons to things like, when we had the civil rights movement here and Congressman John Lewis, you know, walked over the Raymond Pettus Bridge knowing that the police were going to beat him up. But he thought, you know, getting beat up by the police is better than letting the situation of segregation and discrimination, you know, continue without drawing attention to it. You know, I think that people do get to a point where a level of injustice and hopelessness just becomes intolerable. And I do think Israel has some complicity for allowing that to happen, because I think if Israel would have had better governments, and I would also say if the U.S. would have had better governments in the years since the Oslo Accords, you know, we could be much further down a road to a peaceful two-state solution than we are. So I guess that's how I would possibly understand some of the sentiments that you're describing. But I don't think that any of that translates into thinking that that the terrorist attacks were justifiable, or even that Israel's response to them is not justifiable.
Well, this brings us maybe to the last thing we might want to take on this. I mean, and of course, you know, Hamas currently has hostages, and we know at least some of them are American. And so one of the things I've been ruminating on myself, and it's been a while. I'm not always up in war and terrorism, although that's one of my areas. Is, you know, what I can imagine occurring in response to this is we might get some real life bad things happening to those individuals, and I could see that happening on X. I could see that coming out as being both an attempt, as The Atlantic put it earlier today, as kind of trying to pull Israel further into the trap of over responding in a way or in a sense. It could also just be the continuation of the policy that they had from the beginning. But one of the things that for me I think is being overlooked is the fact that you still have individuals who are being theoretically held. This is different as a result of that from previous encounters. This is a first, right? We haven't had this before. And so for me, I can't get away from the fact that that hasn't yet come up, but it surely is or will in a way that's more public. What do you think happens moving forward? Again, my expectation is that Israel rolls in and Hamas's response is to say, we're going to start live streaming somebody, if you, fill in the blank.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of both the hostages mainly, but also just the fact that nobody from Hamas is talking about surrender. That's why I think Israel's response is fully justified. So even though I was trying to make the argument that the people of Gaza have extremely legitimate grievances, that they've been having to live in a situation that nobody should have to live in, it's been completely inhumane. Nonetheless, based on what they did, including taking the hostages, I think until all the hostages are released and until Hamas actually surrenders. I don't see that Israel has any choice but to keep up this really like overwhelming use of force, and so I don't know what's going to happen with the hostages. I don't know if they're still going to have enough electricity there to live stream out anything unless they get moving on that pretty fast. I think there's already no power coming in from the Israeli grid or from the Egyptian grid. They don't have their own grid, so every bit of power that they have has to be because they're generating it from things like gas burning or oil burning generators, and sooner or later they'll run out of gas and oil as well. So I think there are going to be some limits on how well Hamas can communicate things like that out to the world. I think that there is absolutely no reason that Israel should slow down the current assault. Unless the hostages come out and the Hamas leaders surrender. And, if those things would happen, then I would have a lot more qualms about the level of force that Israel is using. And I would really think they should dial that back, but not until then.
And now to kind of answer that question, you were on a roll and I didn't want to stop you earlier, but that seems to me to be also the reason why you have, obviously, historically speaking, the United States has been a close ally to Israel, right? There's just no question about that. But you're right, and you said this a few minutes ago, our particular moderating position has not occurred this go-round, even though we do have a democratic president, which oftentimes seems to be one of at least the empirical times when that's a little bit more likely. And for me, I mentioned a second ago in the broader context, but you've lost American citizens, and simultaneously you have a certain number of them being held hostage, and that would be for me, I think, the reason why you're not seeing that currently. Yeah, what do you think about that take?
Yeah, I'm not even sure with respect to Israel that the partisan split that you posited has been true. I actually think this is an almost unprecedented situation now, where Israel is using massive asymmetric force against Palestinians, and the U.S. is not asking them to dial it back. I think all Democratic and Republican presidents in the past have asked them to dial it back in those kind of situations. And very famously, there's a big Hollywood movie out right now called Golda about the 1973 war. And it's really the Nixon administration that's putting enormous pressure on Israel not to attack back into the Arab countries that attacked them, but rather just to try to repel the Arab armies in the 73 war. And the 67 war is a bit unique, but it all happened so fast, that Israel actually tripled the size of the country in terms of what it was able to occupy in just 5 or 6 days, and with not that much loss of life, right? So it was I think that the politics in America have become, much more unified pro-Israel than it used to be. And maybe the kind of concerns about needing to maintain balance in the eyes of the Middle Eastern Arab countries has diminished some because some of those Middle Eastern Arab countries are actually not squawking that much about Israel's response here either. So, and also Biden, I guess, doesn't get on that well with Saudi Arabia, although he was trying to help broker this peace deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel, but he may be less beholden to them than some of the Republican presidents might have been.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I guess this is where we are. So, I mean, Ken, we've spent a lot of time now on this issue, which I think it deserved. I think it's something that hasn't gotten enough time, hasn't gotten enough thought in these kinds of ways. Anything you'd like to leave us with?
You know, I think that it would be a really good thing if an independent Palestinian state could be established on the West Bank under Fatah. That if the if there was peace and cooperation between that country and Israel, at least at the level that we have seen between Israel and Jordan or Israel and Egypt, and I don't think it's impossible. I think Israel will need to withdraw the settlements that are there. I think some people from Gaza would be able to go there, and so that would relieve some of the pressure on Gaza, which is small and super densely populated. So I think that's probably the best possible solution out. And I do think that the Netanyahu government will fall over this and that we may get a more moderate government in Israel that makes that a little bit more possible. So that's my optimistic spin.
Well, I'll give us one last little thing as well. As we were talking, as a matter of fact, there were some updates coming out, Ken, and the Progressive Caucus actually sent a letter to President Biden asking him to kind of take a more vocal response to what we were just talking about, and that is moderate their response slightly. So that just happened as we were talking about it, and that letter just got shared more broadly. So, you know, we were talking about that, and there you go. But so, you know, I think, we've spent the majority of the show now on that, and I'm absolutely fine with that. But I do want to spend at least a few minutes. I know that'll make us go maybe a little bit long. Yep. On the U.S. House Speaker update, just talk about that a little bit. Obviously, we had two front runners this week. We had Steve Scalise and we had Jim Jordan. But what ended up happening is Jordan ends up putting his weight behind Scalise earlier in the week. But then Scalise just couldn't get the votes by Wednesday, as a matter of fact, when they were supposed to have a new vote in the Republican caucus. They couldn't actually get to that. Depending on who you were talking to, there were somewhere between 12 and 20 holdouts. From Scalise, far more obviously than he can afford to lose to win. And that number only increased as of on Thursday. It got up to about 24, 25, according to a couple of individuals that I know in D.C. And so the hope had been clearly that after becoming the speaker designate, he was going to be able to move quickly forward. But that simply was not the case. And then as of Friday morning, Scalise has now actually pulled out, and that's not a shock. He just clearly didn't have the numbers that were there. But when you take a look at individuals like Representative Womack of Arkansas, who is kind of saying, "Look, we keep getting all these numbers everywhere. People can say one thing, tweet something else, and so we really need to. We're all on the map on this thing." End quote. You know, until there's some votes, it's really hard to see what's going to happen or move forward. You know, Trump never really took a firm position. He supported Jordan early on, but he argued just on Thursday on Fox News Radio that he, quote, liked them very much both. He also kind of took a moderating shot at Scalise, saying, look, that his health is, quote, a serious problem. For those who don't know Scalise, it was diagnosed with multiple myeloma and is in the midst of a chemotherapy journey as we speak. And so, you know, he pulled out again on Thursday. And as a result of that pulling out, there's a couple of individuals who seem to be attempting to replace that spot, although it's not entirely sure who it's going to end up being right now. Ken, what do you think? I mean, again, I think that it was... I think it was a little bit shock. I didn't think, you know, I'm surprised that Scalise was so confident, to be honest, to start with. But from my point of view, it doesn't appear to me that there's any Republican who's going to come forward that can get the votes needed to become Speaker. And if that was Gaetz's goal, I guess congratulations. I don't know, but what do you think? Am I wrong?
No, I mean, it's this it's this cancer that Trump injected into the Republicans of not accepting the results of elections, right? I mean, that's the whole, that is Trumpism, right? It's, and now it's just eating the Republicans up themselves, right? Because they had an election. You know, Scalise won the election against Jordan in the caucus. And like the definition of being a caucus is that you, you know, collectively decide on a decision amongst yourselves, and then you all accept the outcome of the election and support it, right? That's the way it's always been done by Democrats and Republicans in every single prior House Speaker election, right? Within their caucuses, they have an election, and then whoever wins the election within their caucus, they all acquiesce and they say, okay, we'll vote for the winner because he won. But now, like, this idea, well, just because someone wins an election doesn't mean they win an election. You know, it's just that's Republican theology now. And I think if that's the way they want to think about it, then they can't get there, because you're never going to have any candidate that's going to get, you know, what do they need? All but five votes, you know, unless all but four votes. And if Santos gets kicked out, maybe all but three.
True story.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're never going to get there unless people are willing to play by the rule that every prior House of Representatives has played by, which is that once they vote amongst themselves, the people who come out on the short end change their vote, you know. But if they won't do it, they can't get there. And I think that is just a manifestation of this impulse against accepting the legitimacy of elections, which I would associate with Trumpism. But I did read in the Washington Post today that there's maybe a handful of Republicans from that Problem Solvers Caucus who have started reaching out to Democrats. And some of them are saying that they want the Democrats to make them an offer, but that they would consider Democratic offers, like that if the Democrats would put their votes behind a Republican, and then that Republican would then only need about a half a dozen Republican votes to become Speaker. So I think that might be the path that can break this quagmire, because I think there's factions of Republicans large enough that they won't unify amongst themselves. And I think that's what you thought too.
Yeah, no, I don't think that Republicans can unify among themselves. I'm not as, I have seen that floated as well. I don't think that's likely, in large part because, you know, while if you're listening to the show, you know, myself and you, Ken, you know, we follow these kinds of things. The average voter, though, is not going to understand, I think, why, you know, you had Republicans acquiescing to Democrats in order to get their own speaker, right? I mean, again, it does in fact make institutional sense in this particular makedown. That is a really hard case to make. And so while I'm sure that there are some, you know, Republicans making those kinds of things in good faith, I think that that is also not an obvious move forward, because I don't think that's an electorally viable solution, because, again, I don't think that's something that you can put on a bumper sticker. I don't think that's something you can put in an ad, and that's what they need to win.
So I'll agree with your prediction that it's not that likely to happen, but I don't actually agree with your diagnosis that it's not electorally viable, because remember, you only need 5-6 Republicans to do that. Now, there's 18 Republicans who are representing districts that Joe Biden won. You know, so it's only in that group that you have to ask, you know, how much is it going to harm a Republican who's representing a district that Joe Biden won, that Republican works with Democrats to elect a Republican as Speaker? Right, perhaps even for one of them to elect themselves as Speaker, as a Republican. I don't see that that's electoral poison in the districts, you know, in those 18 districts.
Maybe. I mean, I hear what you're saying in that, and I don't disagree with your empirical analysis of those particular individuals. But I can imagine that if you are Republican in one of the districts from which Biden has won, while I understand that analysis, the other way of slicing that is to say, I have to be that much more cognizant that I don't peel off Republican voters and therefore lose in an upcoming election.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could be right. I'm looking at the Washington Post today is naming some names. So they're saying House Armed Services Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, Representative Elvira Salazar from Florida, Representative Don Bacon from Nebraska, These are all Republican members of the House who have been saying that they would like to hear an offer from the Democrats about a power sharing agreement. So that's three names right there. And it would only, you know, it, as we just counted, it would only really require about five or six. So we'll see. But I don't, I mean, otherwise, if that's not the end game, what's the end game? I mean, how do we never have a House of Representatives again until the 24 election?
No, I mean, in all honesty, that's a great question. I wish I had a great answer for that, Ken. But I have, in the same way that I eventually had to decide that I wasn't always quite understanding, it took me time to understand, you know, what the Trump logic is, put it that way. I'm trying to like crawl into Matt Gaetz's brain and figure that out. And I don't have the answer for you.
Yeah, but that's a difficult thing that's going to happen.
Yeah. I think you have to understand him and a few others to really understand it. I mean, I hesitate to even float something because I'm just not confident that I understand even what his purported internal goal would be. I'm not sure yet. I'm going to be honest.
I mean, I think Gaetz had his, it changed, I think. But I think when he did the motion against McCarthy, I actually think he's like the dog who caught the car. I think he really thought that some Democrats would bail out McCarthy and that McCarthy would hang on. And then Gaetz would just get to tar him even more as being like the tool of the Democrats. You know, I think he thought that's what would happen. But when that didn't happen, I actually think his new goal is he thinks he can strong arm. I think he thinks he can strong arm the other Republicans into acquiescing to a far right speaker, if the far right just says we're never gonna let anybody become speaker unless they're from the far right.
But then, of course, I mean, I like that explanation. So don't get me wrong. I mean, I hear that and I see that. But I feel like if I was in his shoes,
you'd be smart by this point. It won't work.
Yeah. Well, even if it wasn't, I would be putting out the person I'd want, right? Like, isn't this the time? This would be the time to start saying, and by the way, my demand is, you know, person X, right?
Well, I think he thought Jordan would fit that bill. I mean, I think he was okay with Jordan, wasn't he?
If he was, he certainly wasn't shouting it too loudly.
Yeah.
and, you know, and at this juncture, if it was, and obviously Jordan had some support, then it seems like he'd be a more obvious, easy answer to put in. But instead, you got individuals like Austin Scott coming back into it. And so I mean, again, I don't disagree with you. In other words, I can't offer a very compelling narrative against it, except for to say, if I was doing it, the thing I would be anticipating, that is, you know, and my suggestion is blank, still isn't forthcoming at the moment that I think it would be forthcoming. But I mean, it could just be also, as you note, if you really have, you know, if you really did catch the car, you might not know what, you know, is it time? I don't know, right? Like, who do I support? It could be one of those things as well. That's true.
Yeah, because I think at that time he just thought like his whole thing is like, I'm going to run against like the uniparty, the deep state, the combined Democratic Republican establishment that runs Washington. I'm going to run against all that. And so if McCarthy had to hang on with some Democratic votes, that would have just played into that narrative that's who Gaetz is against. That see, McCarthy really is part of this, you know, that he'll rely on Democrats because it's the Washington establishment against everybody else. And I think it didn't really occur to Gaetz that wouldn't turn out that way. And so he, then I think he didn't have a plan right away.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think that's as fair as assumption as any. Well, Ken, I'm actually going to cut us off right there because we've already gone long and just say, hey, that's it for this week's show. But I want to have a special shout out, right? So this is the time of the show when we talk about why it's such a good idea to become a supporter of the Politics Guys. And as a matter of fact, we had somebody become a new supporter of the Politics Guys. Warren, thank you. We love that you found something really fun here with myself and with Ken and with Jay and with Mike. And that's just a lot of fun. And so, Warren, thank you so much for becoming a supporter of the Politics Guys. I hope you end up using all of your benefits. And if you're there on Discord, make sure to wave and say hi. I know we've been talking about things on there. But true story, I don't always quite know everybody's real name on Discord. Depends on what you're letting us all know. So if you want to be like Warren, and you should want to be like Warren, you want to get all that free, cool, good stuff, like ad-free versions of the show. So for example, Warren, you know, he didn't have to listen to a mid-break ad for this show. And he's also going to get something really cool. And if he hasn't had it before, he's going to get to go back. Ken and I just finished up the first seven articles, well, the only seven articles, the Constitution, the original Constitution. We just finished up all of the original Constitution. And so now we delve into something that will undoubtedly only take a few weeks, he said jokingly. We're going to take a look at the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Then we're going to move on from there. We're going to go through the entire Constitution. That is part of our supporters exclusive midweek show. So if you haven't been a supporter, you're only getting just a few minutes of that, and then you get cut off, and that sucks. It's kind of like freeware back in the 1990s. You get to like play one episode of Doom, and that was it, you know. And you want to see the rest of it. I'm dating myself, Ken. but what I will say though is if you would like to become a supporter of this show, like Warren, it's time to do it, and you can do that by heading to politicsguys.com/support or by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support the show on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys, and that includes things like PayPal. Again, all of those support, all of those links are in the show notes. And again, if you'd like to head to a website, that's politicsguys.com/support. But we really do, the best way to do that is Patreon, and to head to patreon.com/politicsguys. So you're going to get things, like I just said, like the midweek show. Ken and I are going to start our first show on the Bill of Rights in just a few moments. We'd love for you to be there for that, to get to listen to all of it. And depending on the level of support you are, you also get cool things, like I was mentioning, like the Politics Guys Discord group. There's even Politics Guys gear and all different kinds of benefits at different levels. So again, I'm going to ask you to head to politicsguys.com/support or to patreon.com/politicsguys if you want to do any of that. Now, if you're in a like to get that midweek show, but you're just not in the position financially to support the podcast, we get it. Just email mike@politicsguys.com, and then we're going to get you all set up, and I'll shoot you that out. So whether you're a supporter or not, we really would appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever podcast app you use. That is a really big deal for the show, so please do that. If you've got a question or a comment or anything else you'd like to share with us, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and X, and you can find all of those links in the show notes. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, Don Oglesby, and Ivan English. We'll be back with a new episode. I hope you'll join us then.